This episode of the Keen on Yoga podcast is sponsored by Moments, the booking system we use and highly recommend. Moments allows you to set up classes, workshops, courses, retreats, and appointments, either online, in person, or hybrid. You can take payments using Stripe and PayPal, and the Zoom integration means that clients will automatically receive their link to join. It's easy for you and for your customers. Moments is great for solo teachers right up to studios with multiple sites. If you do run a studio, the staff payroll feature allows you to manage teacher payments and more. The robust reporting and time-saving automations will save you hours on admin. It really does take care of the whole business side for you. The excellent team at Moments will help you set up or migrate from any other system, and best of all, they offer real support via phone, live chat, and email. They really are there to help whenever you need them. Right now, Keen on Yoga listeners can get a free 2-month trial for Moments. Click the link in the description below or visit keenonyoga.com/moments, M-O-M-E-N-C-E, to sign up and give it a go. You'll be glad you did. If you have any questions about Moments, feel free to drop us a line at info@keenonyoga.com or via message on any of our social channels. And now, on to the episode.
So today's guest on the Keen on Yoga podcast is Ruth Westerby. She's a doctoral candidate at SOAS. I can't remember what the topic of your thesis is, Ruth.
Yeah, bodies in early hatha yoga is my thesis. I'm looking at models of the yogic body. So how the body is described in the sources, and then how should we understand yogic body models of kundalini, bindu rajas, and like baking the body. So if physical techniques work, if that's the kind of rationale or raison d'etre of the early hatha corpus, that physical yoga techniques are efficacious, then what is their understanding of the body, and how should we understand the yogic body as material physical and sort of yogic, or what is frequently described as subtle body, or like sukshma sharira, kind of how's all that coming together, such that the process of yoga delivers power and liberation.
And we did start a topic, a discussion on this, but it was quite a complicated. So today I think that what we decided to talk about was the relationship between academia and study. And you can see that Ruth is certainly an academic, and also a practitioner. Ruth has practiced, I think, Ashtanga yoga in London with Hamish Hendry for many years, right? Is that right?
Yeah. I started yoga when I was 16. I went along to yoga class with my mum. He took me to, I guess, hatha yoga, you'd call it. Just, you probably define it as village hall hatha yoga, just in a college in Hereford. And actually, the teacher was the mum of one of my best friends. So we'd do that, and then mum would go home and I'd go to the pub. Yeah, that's how I started. And I went along with another really good friend who went the Iyengar route. So she now has a local yoga studio, and I go and practice with her. And then I moved to London to do my undergraduate, and Norman Blair became my teacher, and I practiced with him for a few years. And then he took me to Hamish's, and the sweet, sweet man got up really early because I had to go before work, met me at the tube, took me for Hamish's, put my mat out next to him, and I just copied him because I didn't know the sequence. So kind of got through the primary, and then was like, whoa, this is all really hot. I really want a drink of water. So I think I started with Hamish in, like, I don't know, the early 2000s, and when they were at Diorama. Yeah.
Right.
And then continued practicing with him. In a sort of very much a sort of family relationship of like you have your highs and your lows, but I think it's definitely my home.
Sorry, you're saying your other teacher?
Well, I'd say my the most influential teacher is Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor. I did their teacher training. I don't know, in like 2008 or 9. and then try to practice with them whenever they come over to the UK. Yeah, so definitely super influenced by Richard and Mary.
Yeah, I think like so many people really. I was talking to someone the other day and saying, you know, before Richard came along with these ideas of technique, and there's really like not any idea other than just trying to just get yourself into the posture, right? You know, I think Richard, he did so much to kind of, so much to kind of develop and evolve Ashtanga yoga. And incredible. And Mary, in fact, as well. Had Mary in the podcast as well. She's fantastic as well. And a good chef, it turns out, you know. Mary's a trained gourmet chef. So we had lots to talk about on that front. Anyways, today, so we're going to try and keep on program. And today we wanted to talk about the relationship between academic studies of yoga, which I think increasingly people are getting into yoga philosophy, even if they're not academics. Most of us are not, including me. I'm no way an academic, although I talk to them and I like them. And practitioners. And most or many academics are also practitioners, or they got into it due to practice. And how the two intersect and maybe complement each other. Because some people will say, and I know that there's a lot around the modern academic scholarship, there's a lot of people kind of annoyed at the start or somewhat upset about, say, Mark Singleton's book or Norman Soyman's Traditions of the Mysore Palace, that is some, you know, somewhat kind of debunked yoga or somehow, you know, a kind of cynical take on, you know. Well, you know, let's just start from saying, you know,
I'm having to make notes, man.
Your own benefits. I was wondering what you're doing. I thought you maybe replying
like,
someone's email. I mean, I think that there's this feeling that, you know, a lot of people had when they got the works of, say, Singleton in their hands, that he'd done a great disservice to yoga in some respects, right? And I think this goes on to today, that the idea that it's kind of heresy to suggest that all the asanas didn't come from, you know, from way back the when, and the Yoga Karunta, or had some, you know, the Vedas even, exactly. So, I mean, it kind of spirals also into what is yoga and how, you know, and the conversations about appropriation. But if we start at the start, what would you say is that has been your benefit through more study of the text, and do you see any pitfalls in terms of applying a kind of Western rationalism to a body of knowledge that doesn't really necessarily move along the same lines?
Oh my God, you are so many touched on so many things there. Western rationalism.
Sorry.
Right. So I like academics too. I feel like I feel very at home with people who are wildly interested in something to the extent that sometimes one's social skills drop off. But that's okay, because we're just nerds. So I suppose one way into it is like how I got into the more academic study of yoga. So, yeah, having practiced at Hamish's for a while, I said, so go on then, what's all this about? Give me a book. And he gave me the Bhagavad Gita. So I went away, got on the tube, read a bit of it, came back to yoga the next day, reading Gita on the tube. I was like, Hamish, you gave me the wrong book. It's like about a war. Have you read this? And I remember speaking to Richard Freeman about sort of the academic study of yoga. And I think when I went to do when I went to Boulder to practice with them, I was doing my master's degree at SOAS, which at the time was because now they have the master's program Traditions of Yoga and Meditation, but that wasn't running at the time. So I was doing Indian religions, like the pathway, the Indian religions pathway of the sort of study of religions. And now I can't remember the phrase that Richard used, but it was like the problem with academic studies is it sort of turns you into a, I definitely don't recall the exact words, but it was, you know, it makes you so obsessed by sort of facts and data and what you can prove, and you might lose sight of the flow and the glory of it all.
Yeah.
But I catch myself quite frequently with what I'm studying sort of realizing how influenced I have been by Richard in terms of some of the things that he'll teach as part of a class. And then I find myself, you know, years later searching for that through the sources. So I probably have turned into a bit of a, you know, obsessed with stuff, with detail. You talked a little bit about Mark Singleton's work and Norman Seoman's traditions of the Mysore Palace, yeah, both of which are just here. Norman Seoman was the yoga tradition of the Mysore Palace. when I first read Mark Singleton's book, and then you kind of, you asked about pitfalls of Western rationalism. I think there's a load of stuff to go in around like the scholar practitioner relationship. What is that? Can one be a, can you divide them out? Are they always together? What are the risks and benefits of that connection is a really interesting thing to talk about. I wasn't aware of the controversy around Norman Seoman's book. What was the problem there? What was the criticism of his work?
Yeah, I think some people were pretty upset. I mean, Norman has been on the podcast, and I think he mentioned that some people were pretty upset at the time that he kind of was seeming to claim, well, I mean, you know, basically kind of saying that it came from the Tathagatanidhi, that the, you know, Krishnamacharya took a lot, if anything, from the Tathagatanidhi and not from the Yoga Karunta. And also that the idea that, you know, he mentions in the book that Rama Mohan Brahmacharya, perhaps if he was existent, was more in a state of Karnataka rather than, you know, towards the Himalayas. That was that was another one of his footnotes. He also suggests that Krishnamacharya maybe studied rather closer to home. So there's a few things that, you know.
I had one yoga teacher who refused to give me a book on yoga. I was like, so what's all this about? And she was like, no, I'm not telling you, not lending you the book. Practice. Go and practice for a few years and then read a book. Right. So I can kind of see where you're coming from on that. So with Mark Singleton's work, when I first read it, I was like, oh my God, this is the discontinuity thesis. And that's how I read it. I read it as saying, look, this is what's new about the modern practice of yoga. But I think I was completely sort of wrong in how I was understanding that. He was doing a really specific project in his work, which was to analyze the materials produced in a short time frame, and to say, right, what are the influences in those manuals on physical culture developing in India? I'm going to get the time period wrong, but was it sort of the 1890s was his sort of key period? And he did a blinder of a job. Like, his book, I think, is still 10 years on, absolutely groundbreaking. And I think it's fabulous scholarship. And I think he writes like an angel. I once contacted him and said, Mark, how do you write so well? What should I read to be able to write like you? Anyway, I'll just drop my standards and
I know.
Not right like that. So I think the thesis,
right,
and
brevity
I don't
is a gift.
Think he's arguing the discontinuity thesis. I think he's arguing, he's saying just what are the influences on yoga at that time. He's not saying there is no continuity, there is no historicity to this practice. He's not doing that. But I think that's how the yoga community and practitioners picked up on that and felt offended that that the longevity was being criticized. And we care. I think practitioners tend to care really deeply about questions of authenticity, because you and I and many out there have spent many hours on the mat. You know, we're deeply intrigued by this thing and we're really, really going as far as we can go into it. So you want it to be right. You want it to be true. You want it to be valid. You want it to have a purpose. And if people start saying, oh, but like questioning that, it's really discombobulating, destabilizing. And like, well, what is the point of this thing if it's just, you know, I want it to have that historicity. So Mark has a chapter in a different book called The Classical Reveries of Contemporary Practice, which I think, yeah, I mean, he's just been asking some absolutely brilliant questions.
I was upset by it when I read it, first of all. because you kind of feel that those, sorry to interrupt, because you feel that those postures, you know, they have, when you're doing it, they're so strange, but then, and they're also so challenging that you kind of want them to have some kind of further energetic significance or symbolism, you know. And if you feel like when Mark points out that perhaps that they're taken from, you know, the circus or, you know, other traditions, you know, of Western, even Western cultural calisthenics, that you kind of feel like a bit shortchanged there. Like, oh, you know, is that all they are then? Just exercise, when, you know, I was taking them to be some kind of further energetic work, you know. And I think there's a kind of maybe some conflation there between also a number of different systems. Well, one, you've got a system of Patanjalian idea within Krishnamacharya's matrix, and the other is a tantric one, really, you know. And is it an energetic practice, or is it a practice for concentration? Two maybe other sidebars as well. They often get kind of joined in together. Sorry,
yeah,
it's going down another avenue, isn't it?
I think Mark was sort of saying that you've got a certain range of movements that the human body can make, and different practices do these movements. So harmonial gymnastics, Ling, you might find the same movements, and yeah, they may have cross-pollinated, but the conceptual frame underneath them may be different. So what you understand when you're doing something is unique to the kind of context in which you are practicing, or that series of postures have a meaning. So I don't think he was saying there's no meaning to these things. He was saying that, isn't it fascinating that the body can do these things and these movements are traveling? And what is what's the worldview underpinning them? And also, how postured, like modern history of asana is really interesting, that sun salutations were not considered asana prior to the 1930s, that you don't have asymmetrical side bends before the 20th century. It's all very fascinating. And I think some of the sort of broader overarching questions that impact scholarship and a sort of that both impact scholarship and impact sort of the practitioner. Sorry, I'm in the UK and I've got my full season sleeping bag wrapped around me because it's pretty cold here. Oh, I'm getting really cold.
Oh, God.
It's just to keep the water. And I had to turn the heater off, so I didn't have
to. Yeah, I know.
So I think there are some kind of broader questions around like time, like how we understand time and how we attribute thought and scholarship and authorship. I don't like sort of using the East-West dichotomy because I don't think it's that helpful. But in sort of the modern Western academy, the idea is like one person comes up with one idea. So my thesis that I'm desperately trying to work on at the moment, you know, it needs to have this unique contribution to thought, which I read somewhere was like a polite fallacy that a thesis can actually be a unique contribution, because of course we're all in this together. It's one big conversation and we're all feeding and developing. And your thesis is as much a product of the advice scholarship that you have been embedded in than your own thing. Anyway, we have this polite fallacy that we can have this unique idea that is somehow ours and that is somehow sort of better than. And then we name that, you know, what's the phrase that you've come up with that you can plaster all over social media that's your kind of unique contribution? And then, you know, you copyright it and stuff like that. So, and I think we have a Hegelian view of time, like history is progress and history is improving. There's this kind of teleological purpose to it. And if you kind of take those ideas and put them into the Indian context, it just doesn't fit, does it? Yeah, cyclical ideas of time, but time is degenerating. It's we have the yugas and it's a degeneration through time. So there is that cyclical purpose sense to it, but it's not teleology, it's soteriology. A function of time is different. We're trying to become free from that sort of round of rebirth. And then when you think about sort of ideas and new ideas, well, there aren't any new ideas. Like in the beginning was the word, and the word was Om, and the pranava is the reverberation of the universe from which the cyclic eons reverberate out. And within the pranava are all of the teachings. So all of the teachings are there. They're perennial. They are just articulated in different words at different times. So there is nothing unique. One person didn't think of this truth for the first time. And you don't say, well, I have written this text and it comes up with new things. No, you name it by your teacher. Because that's a work, that's an attribution of the credit of those ideas to your teacher. And then, yeah, so this is where the kind of the Western academic approach kind of hits up against Indian concepts of time, because we'll try and date things by like, well, that idea was first set out in that text and we're going to date that text to this particular time. And then you've got a big clash, haven't you? Because you're saying it's not as old as, and a more sort of Indian approach would be, yeah, might clash with that. So, and then to come back around to kind of practitioners, when people say, oh, that, yeah, coming up against the works of Norman Yeoman and Mark Singleton, it might feel that those myths are being busted, but I don't read their work in that way at all. And the whole Yoga Karunta, Sri Tattva Nadi Norman Yeoman was basing his work on, well, yeah, Jacqueline Hargreaves and Jason Birch are doing such fascinating work on that. And with the Hatha-Vyasa Padati, the text, which is it's a written description of six sequences of postures, whereas the Sri Tattva Nidhi, which predates the Hatha-Vyasa Padati, but only by a little bit, the Sri Tattva Nidhi is an illustrated manual, and they're relatively close. Like you can kind of...
Yeah.
Put one picture against one description and sort of try and work it out that way. But I think Jason and Church, Jacqueline and Jason have been doing further research on this stuff and like eyes wide open. Hopefully there'll be more stuff coming from them soon.
Yeah, I had them on the podcast and I think they spent a couple of days with Norman and then there was something like in my attic or something like that, Oh my God, because Norman's this kind of like bumbling old kind of academic. It's like, I think I've got something up there, they looked at it. It's like, oh wow, this is a huge connection. This is a huge find. On a personal note, I wondered okay, you've been doing this stuff for a number of years. It came out of your interest in practice, that you were a practitioner first and foremost, how has it, on a more pragmatic level, how has it actually complemented and enriched your practice, this kind of research? Because, I mean, another kind of this dichotomy or polarity to draw would be between emic and etic and the kind of modes of perception, right? So one is reading the text prima facie on face value, and the other is a kind of a critical thinking or a rationalistic perspective and comparative, like reading the text from outside, which we tend to do these days, right? And this is where... often you have Indians getting rather upset with Western academics who are reading it and kind of cross-pollinating or making cross connections between text and trying to relate it to other things rather than reading the text on face value. How do these texts inform your practice and how do you read them?
Okay, good question. So when I first started doing, I started doing yoga out of a physical practice. And I hated competitive sports. I was super shy and unconfident. And I absolutely hated my body. And having a mat that I could stay on and I didn't have to get off and definitely not interact with other people because that's awful was absolutely fantastic. So I had my mat. I was safe. Lighting was dark. And gradually, through the physical practice, had a wonderful experience, finding out all of these things. But that could have been through sort of running or something else. And I think the magic of yoga is that you scratch the surface and you find a universe. You find this phenomenal literature, these just stunning philosophical systems and metaphysical systems, and you can just plunge so deep. Whereas if it was gymnastics or running or something, I don't think that my interest would have been sustained for this long. You know, I'm less the anatomy and physiology side and more the sort of history and philosophy and metaphysics of it. Yeah, so it was scratching the surface and then finding this sort of ocean that you could dive into. And then how did the sort of theories and texts perhaps inform the physical practice? Well, I'd have to kind of definitely acknowledge Richard Freeman in terms of, I think one of the things he is brilliant at is expressing the teachings in a sort of contemporary poetry that, you know, read Bhagavad Gita chapter 4 with him, sort of pouring the breath into the breath, pouring the inhale into the exhale, the ablation into the ablation into the ablation. And you can take those sort of ideas and play with them on the mat. You practice with him and then you're like, oh my God, I'm just a whole series of tubes. Look, there's a tube there and there's a tube there and it's all tubes and it's all connected. And oh, look, I'm 70% water, 75% water. And just, yeah. And he has you doing breathing practices where you're a fish and you're just like, oh my God, this is just, so I think that within the Indian tradition, we can find some absolutely stunning metaphors within the texts as well that I find can be really productive on the mat in the practice. But I would never go to my mat, recite a verse and say, you know, my intention, I have a sankalpa for my practice and that it is to think about this. That is guaranteed not to work. I would always just think about something else. But I tend to sort of try and keep it as simple as possible. So it's not like I will be developing this line of inquiry in my practice. It's whatever arises and then trying to keep it as simple. And, you know, as you go through the Ashtanga practice, it's challenging in so many ways. It's challenging in terms of the complexity and physical difficulty of it. And then it, after you've done it for a certain number of years, it's challenging in terms of sort of just keeping going and how things evolve and change as well. You know, as one gets older, one's practice changes. I now don't live in London, so I practice at home and kind of top up by going into the shala when I can. Do you want to know my practice hack? This is really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone. Yeah.
Because it's really hard to do home practice when you're used to practicing in a Mysore environment, which I feel I have done for like my whole yoga life, really. So now, don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
I like put techno on or any sort of music with a good beat. And then I get like a podcast or a PDF and I play it out loud on super fast speed. So it's a little bit hectic. It's not very relaxing.
With the techno as well.
And if you've got... Yeah. So you just need to get your levels right so that you're getting a beat. And then I'll have to stop and make notes.
Oh, my God. That is brilliant.
But like my home practice is...
And the podcast is going on fast speed and the techno is going. Wow. Fantastic.
Well, no, the podcast, I tend to just play at normal speed. But if you're playing a PDF out loud, you can...
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. What about some lights? Maybe some lights there as well. Some flashing lights.
I hadn't thought of that. My kids do have some. Yeah,
add a bit of an extra stimulation there. Yeah. Right. So, what about intention? You talked of intention then. So, as you know, as you kind of go through reading yoga texts, and you know, we have this, as I mentioned before, these kind of different kind of. They're kind of different templates, really, as you start to kind of really, you know, like kind of explore the ideas of yoga. You know, Jim talks, you know, most succinctly and clearly about yoga being basically tapas, you know, an ascetic practice for a disjoint or unyoking of the body. And then we have, you know, later on a more kind of body positive spin, really, that we're more keen on today, really, this idea of coming into the body and empowering it kind of in a more tantric way. And then, you know, people get very, very happy about talk of the chakras and the nadis and, you know, Kundalini and this kind of thing, right? You know, how has knowing a little bit about the tradition of yoga informed your intentions around it? And have you seen any discrepancies between your approach and what you've been doing or what you've been wanting to do? Can you say anything about that?
I mean, so I practice physical posture. I don't particularly sit. I don't particularly do much pranayama. It's a physical practice. And I think we have to acknowledge the kind of contemporary context in which asana has become the predominant form of yoga. And that is very not that there are so many discontinuities with the historical tradition in which sitting, mantra, visualization, you know, all those other aspects of the practice were hugely important. So we do have to recognize the discontinuity in why and how in the specific practices that we're doing. Then you have to look at worldview as well. Like, why do we practice yoga? What do we believe in that informs our yoga practice? And then do a bit of historical analysis. So Indian, the kind of foundational principles of Indian thought are karma, samsara, dukkha, moksha, that the world is a wheel of becoming, of repeated birth and death that is characterized by suffering, that is propelled by karma, the consequential action. And then what we're trying to do is to become free from the round of rebirth. So that's why you do yoga. You do yoga to become free. It, particularly in the Hatha yoga sources, you do yoga to become powerful. And then how does that power play out? What do they mean by that? Well, often in the sources, yeah, you've got your siddhis, your superhuman attainments, becoming young, becoming light, small, flying, hearing the sounds of all different things. So you've got all of those siddhis, and you've also got power over. So the yogi develops these powers beyond the human of control over their own body, such that you can take any form at will, you know, bilocate, all of those different things, and power over other people. You become attractive to other people, akarshana. There's this kind of charisma or drawing in. So you power over your own body, power over the people around you, the people and the animals and the kind of beings in the world, and then power over the world itself. You can range through the cosmos. You can become created, the creation and destruction of the worlds. So that's a whole heap of stuff that that we don't believe in, or that doesn't particularly inform modern yoga practice, where we have a completely different set of worldviews, which is progress, capitalism, neoliberalism. So we're not looking to. Most people don't believe in reincarnation, so we're not looking to come free from the round of rebirth. So slam, we have just cut away one of the foundational reasons that people would have done yoga. So therefore, why are we doing yoga? I think the kind of neoliberal paradigm is so deeply influential that we don't see it. Margaret Thatcher won. We are individuals. We are responsible for our own perfection in the world. We are judged by that. So do yoga to get a good body, to support you to stay in the sausage machine of working and producing. And yoga will enable you to do that because you'll be able to cope with the stresses and strains of that. You are responsible for looking beautiful and young and the right size and shape. Society will not, no such thing as society. Anyway, slight rant, but therefore, why do we do yoga? Do yoga because
as long as you grew up under Thatcher, you can't, you know.
I'm a Thatcher baby.
I think, well, you know, we were all in it, weren't we? And yeah, and she did have a big, I mean, people outside UK probably won't understand it. Well, look to Reagan, same thing.
Similar. Yeah, well,
yeah, maybe really. Not with great hair, not as good hair. Yeah, and the heels and the blue.
Yeah,
but what about the? We can go on about Thatcher. You know, she's a great woman. But you know, if you were in that time and place in the generation, she did define England at the time, and what's gone on since then has been, you know, very relevant. You know,
to what UK is today.
But anyway, that's politics. yeah, yeah, yeah. We don't need to go down that line. But I think in a way we fall between two stools, don't we? That, you know, one is like a rejection of the body and, you know, a complete abnegation. So it's kind of ironic when people talk about yoga as union these days. And that's the thing you hear all the time, yoga is union. And actually it's like, well, you know, generally not. Generally for most of the time, it's been a kind of rather an escape from, you know, an escape from the body and the kind of union that people are currently in. It may be a union with the divine, but not the really the union that people are usually talking about when they say yoga is union, which is a kind of quasi kind of emotional kind of psychological kind of integration rather than, you know, a union with the divine. People aren't doing yoga to see God anymore, right? And then the other, which is this, you know, empowering the body so it will kind of fly and do all this, you know, kind of wacky stuff that, you know, I think maybe we'd like to think that, but I think most people probably, or rather they're looking for a further embodiment, probably aren't really going to kind of endorse the fact that they are trying to kind of get superpowers and control of other people's minds, etc. So we kind of fall between two stools in a way really. And so looking for a precedent as to what we're currently doing is rather, you know, kind of rather difficult, in because we are doing something kind of new in a way in terms of most people's aspirations towards yoga. But I mean, do you think it has changed at all your aspirations towards yoga in learning about the
mine in,
you know, the kind of history and a wider kind of context of it or not?
Okay, well, there's like I was just looking at the time because I know you said 40 minutes and that I could open a massive can of worms at this point.
As long as it's entertaining, then I'm happy to go on. And also, we want to get into the appropriation a bit, which will kind of come from, you could take it from here, really.
That was where I was going to go, in the sense that, I guess I teach on history and philosophy teacher trainings a bit. I kind of go in and do the the history and philosophy modules, and a lot of it is around like, I'm not expecting you to sort of stand up in front of your class and quote chapter and verse and then do some asana. Rather, it's setting out the history, the ways in which these things have developed, in order to understand more about why we're doing this practice. And to just, so Tarka, the, you know, cogitating, thinking, analyzing, I think that is a practice of yoga, as much as, meditation, pranayama, mantra, asana. From the Maitri Upanishad, Tarka is one of the limbs of the six limbs. So do I see, I guess I'm verging on sort of saying, I see academic studies is a form of yoga. I think that critical thinking is a form of yoga. It's not like these are the teachings, believe them. It's like these are the teachings from the teacher, from the text, from the community. Now think about them. And even within Vedanta, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we've got manana, you know, think about it. Shravana, listen to it. Manana, think about it. Nididhyasana, meditate on it, contemplate on it more deeply. I just see all of this material as feeding, as kind of nourishing, as fascinating, and as an absolutely integral part of practice that keeps me deeply, deeply fascinated and wanting to continue to study and to do physical practice. I can't wait to finish my thesis because then I'm just going to practice more. You know, people say that you, like finishing your thesis, you get like post-thesis depression because you, this thing that you were trying to give birth to for so many years is gone.
Meaning so anymore.
I've got something to put into that gap. My practice has ailed. It feels like I've been trying to produce a thesis, but it's locked in some kind of weird ongoing childbirth. It's quite traumatic. Anyway, we need to get there, but I don't actually think I necessarily answered your question. It was, how does all of this stuff feed it and the kind of cultural appropriation stuff?
I was just kind of reflecting, reading the Bhagavad Gita, actually, how that you've got, you've always got this battle in the Bhagavad Gita between which is better, you know, the practice of Karma Yoga or the practice of Jnana Yoga, you know, the practice of Samkhya, you know, and this one is basically reflection, isn't it? One is reflection and discrimination, and the other is a practical yoga. And it's like, well, there's always been this kind of attempt then to kind of bridge the two between, because you have to use some sense of discrimination about practice, otherwise it could just be jumping around on the spot, you know. And on the other hand, there's this idea, isn't there, that comes, you know, that's come throughout embodied somatic practices, that there's something in the body to be purged, or I have a problem with the word purified, but that, you know, this idea that there's an energy in the body that, you know, to be purified, as well as a mental kind of purification going on, and the two have to kind of have some kind of interrelation with each other. Just mental stuff is like, well, kind of, you know, just like, you know, mental masturbation, you know, potentially. And, you know, and physical stuff on its own is just, you know, it's just jumping around doing, you know, some exotic gymnastics, really, or, you know, God, you know, yeah, just for the sake of.
Yeah, well, then you get to the kind of Cartesian split, don't you? Mind, is it mind or body? Can we ever separate those things out? So my thesis introduction does a big, you know, Cartesian stuff that we're all. It's mind and body already, and then it's also body and yogic body. So, yeah, so it's all one thing. I don't think that the early Hatha sources make a disconnect between yoga, the normal, the sort of mundane body, and the yogic body, and neither do they particularly make a distinction between the body and the mind. So it's all in the pot. It's all being cooked, as the yoga bija would say. Bake the body in the fire of yoga, because unbaked bodies are lumps of meat, and that gnosis alone, meditation alone, will not help, because you'll be, when you are scratched by ants and bitten by scorpions attempting to do your meditation, it's not going to work. So therefore, bake the body in the fire of yoga, and you attain a majestic yogic body, a great yogic body. An empowered, but it's not really a yogic body. It's a body. You know, you're developing this amazing body of yoga, which is necessary for doing the contemplation, the gnosis, the jnana yoga. Mm. That alone is not enough, because your body causes you pain. Your body is the source of pain. So bake it. Which I think Ashtanga Yoga is kind of like, got that one nailed, hasn't it? How'd you bake it? Like this.
The heating that goes with a lot of these practices, and the physical heating as well, because there's mental heat, you know, when you're sitting there really trying to think. I mean, I studied philosophy at university, like logic, I remember, just like mental overheating. And then, you know, it's just kind of useful in a way, because it feels like a kind of purification of your mind. And then, you know, which mathematicians I really think get, you know, and then you've got the purification of your body when you just do something very hot, you know, that's very consistently disciplined and hot, you know, not just running around a football field and, you know, 30 degrees, you know, it doesn't really produce the same effect, or didn't for me. But, you know, anything, you know, it's like Bikram, he kind of realized, oh, you know, turn the dial up on the heating, and it kind of works in a different manner here, you know. We wanted to talk a little bit about the appropriation thing, because I want to hear your views on that and what you think of that, because then you kind of we're kind of cut free and loose then, if we haven't got some clear precedent to what we're currently doing, to then interpret it in any way. So I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, recorded one, with an Indian lady practitioner, who was talking about how, you know, how offensive it is for a lot of Indians to see how yoga is being taken in the West, you know, yoga for rock hard abs and yoga for booty, a nice booty, or whatever it is, you know, we were talking about, you know, and can it, you know, it strikes me as, I'm not sure we could ever fully understand it, because it is so culturally embedded. Is there a method that we can extrapolate out that and use it outside a culture, or is it something which really is located within a certain cultural context and an understanding of a worldview, you know?
Oh gosh, that's really so many things there. So I think with the kind of critique,
I know,
of
I tend
appropriation,
to
or
confuse a number of points,
appropriation of kind of the sort of politics of sort of insult and things like that. I think that that's all deeply important, and one mode of response is to study the history and philosophy. So that's kind of tackles the question of like the relevance. What is the relevance of appreciating the historical context of yoga? Well, it's to respond to the risk or fact in some people's perspectives that the way that yoga is practiced is a misappropriate and an offensive one at that. So that's a first point, is take the context seriously. And then you talked on the one hand about sort of like cutting loose, like is there something that we're sort of, we can take out of one context, cut loose from that context, and then do within other contexts. Oh, my email has just opened up. I had tried to shut everything down. So I guess that's sort of questions around like essentialism and relativism. Is it still yoga if you've cut it loose from a context? And I really like contexts. Mm. I like seeing how things are within certain contexts. So explore the context in which we are doing these practices. That's why the critical theoretical perspective, sort of saying, what are your blind spots? What are your perspectives? What are your, like, okay, we tend perhaps, like, say in the UK, feel sort of like post-religious or something, you know, but what takes up those spaces? What are the worldviews that we're bringing with us that we might not see? So I think critical theory, and I put that in the same bag as kind of tarka, as like critical inquiry into the teachings, like do that. That's a really important part of the yoga practice. Try to see the context. Like critical theory is asking us to look back into our blind spots to see the context in which we are operating. And I think we need to do that within whatever context we're practicing yoga, and then reflect on the context from which yoga has developed. And I'm not saying sort of we should be trying to replicate something, which then, and so the risk of my argument is that you become so relative that if we don't have, if nothing is sacred, then what remains? But I think we have to start from where we are.
And that's, that relativism.
Impute.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, that would be to be something other than what we are. But on the other hand, we bring that relativism into yoga is in a certain sense an appropriation itself, isn't it? Because that's our baggage onto yoga. Whereas, you know, I mean, critical thinking in the first place is the ability to hold a number of ideas equanimously, you know, a number of ideas at the same time and weigh them up against each other, right? Whereas, you know, yoga thinking really is more based. I mean, look at all the texts, they suggest faith, right? You know, so as long as you've got faith, you've got the obliteration of a whole bunch of different ideas and doubts, and the attempt to hold just one idea at the expense of all others, which is a different model of looking at things, or a way of treating one's own faculties than Western critical thinking. Okay, on yoga.
So I guess you're sort of positing sort of like shudder or like faith in something. So I don't necessarily see those things as in conflict. I think one can have faith. One can have faith in the teachings. One can have faith in the lineage and the tradition and the community without saying that like dogma and doctrine is true. You know, we're held within this sort of tradition of practices and people. So that would be my response to, I don't think we have to believe in a sense that there are truths that we have to take as absolute, that we can't question. Yeah. I think that they are contextualized. And so one of the problems with cultural appropriation and with yoga as a thing is, what is yoga? And we tend to homogenize and essentialize. So we tend to say there was a historical point at which yoga was yoga, and we should be, that's this anxiety for authenticity, which is a subheading of Mark Singleton's in one of his books, one of his chapter contributions, I think. So, and I just adore it. this idea of an anxiety for authenticity, that there, we spend so much time doing these things, we're so deeply committed, yoga is so much kind of part of our lives, but are we doing the right yoga? So let's study the text and find out what the right yoga is. Okay, is it Patanjali yoga? Is that what we should be doing? Well, we shouldn't be doing very much asana then, if that's the case. The problem with saying that there is one great yoga is that everything before that was just kind of incrementally leading up to it and isn't somehow valid in its own right, and that everything after that is a degeneration, a sort of polluted, corrupted by external influences. But so what are, I would much prefer to kind of look at the different contexts and look at what and how and why people are doing certain things within certain contexts, and what are the, you can do like polythetic analysis, like what are the characteristics within each of those contexts that are the same or different? What are the worldviews that are the same or different? And it's not to kind of judge and to say one thing is better than the other, which is where you then fall into relativism, because you're saying, well, therefore, does it just not matter what I'm practicing? If I call it yoga, it's yoga. I don't think I would go that far. But I'm really keen not to set up a golden age from which everything is degeneracy. And the problem with the cultural appropriation, there are lots of kind of problems with the sort of arguments around cultural appropriation. But one of which is the ownership paradigm. So if we think cultural, we tend to see cultural appropriation within a kind of idea of physical artifacts that can be owned, and that is difficult to then talk about when it's religious, spiritual and cultural practices, because they don't fit the ownership paradigm in the same way. So that's one of the issues with it. And then another issue is like the sort of essence of the thing. So if we step across into like the heritage sector and museums and restitution, the sending artifacts back to countries, one of the ways in which that idea falters a little bit is you're thinking that the place of origin has not changed, that somehow the place of origin is this homogenous historical continuity but things change over decades and centuries, and there is no, I don't think that there is a homogenized sort of yoga that is yoga. It's context specific, based on the beliefs and practices that people and communities are doing at certain times. So cultural appropriation is a sticky one. I would hope that one way in which we can sort of acknowledge that, because hurts are a part of this, and so one way in which we can acknowledge this is through study.
And yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting subject, especially for me more recently traveling more around Southeast Asia and India as well, and coming to India and seeing now how they've adopted, say, you know, we're sitting in a cafe and you're listening to them playing rock songs that I knew, like play very English ones for a certain time and place, right? So they're enjoying them, they're interpreting them and they're feeling them in a certain manner, right? But one sense a feeling of ownership, you know, from certain London bands, for example, of, well, those are our songs, you know, and that's a small feeling to how, you know, maybe an Indian person feels. Is it justified on either side? Do you know what I mean? Because I might not have been, you know, was looking at, say, the Beatles. I wasn't around when they were doing those songs, you know, it's like, and they weren't around when the Indian yogis were sticking, you know, doing their practices. So, you know, so you also talk about, you know, homogenized people, and something, can something be separated from a cultural context? And are they allowed to interpret those songs in their own way, or can they get as much out of those songs as I can because I have a different cultural perspective or context around them?
Are they allowed? So that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's a number of questions, isn't there? But but it definitely sets me up more thinking about it, having seen it from the other side, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the kind of the academic relativism is then that one is attempting not to be judgmental. So it's, I'm just fascinated by how these things are arising in different contexts rather and don't feel I have to make any sort of judgment. So the kind of academic perspective, I suppose, is a pursuit of objectivity, which is of course impossible, especially if we have all of these sort of blind spots that may be informing our work that we have perhaps not acknowledged. So academia itself is this kind of process of trying to kind of unpack the context that we're coming from all the time with a kind of attempt towards some sort of objectivity. Oh man, I'm not quite sure where I was going with this. Am I supposed to be answering a question? I've lost myself.
But it's a difficult one, really, isn't it? You know,
there's no, there's kind of no judgment or So the problem with academia is that academics are really good at kind of analyzing and setting out problems, but don't particularly engage in solutions. And academia has not always functioned as a site for the production of solutions. It's functioned as the site for kind of knowledge generation and criticism, but not sort of political engagement necessarily. And I guess where you were coming at with your questions, that was more of a kind of, what is the solution? And I don't think there is one solution. And I think academics are a bit cheeky, but I'm going to take that route out, which is, it's not really for me to posit the solution, and it's seeing that contexts are complicated because they're people. We're all complicated. We all have our different takes and contexts.
Well, I think that's a pop out, isn't it?
Ooh, do you?
No. I mean, you know, it's a difficult one. But I mean, look, for example, one of the videos I get the most slack on is Edwin Bryant, you know, a lovely guy and friend of mine, talking about Yoga Sutras or Bhagavad Gita, right? You know, I mean, he's a super well-known academic. He's done his stuff on it, you know. I mean, if anyone has authority to talk on these texts, it's probably Edwin. He's learned the Sanskrit. He does from the original text. But you'll have constant Indians fighting back on this. You know, this is a white guy talking about our culture, you know. And I can understand the point. You know, I can understand it. I mean, can you ever – I mean, so the point goes deeper. I'm not expecting an answer from you. But, you know, can someone really from the outside – ever fully understand which is something which is more, which goes deeper than that in a way? You know, there's some sense of ownership or culture surrounding this thing. So we're always kind of looking at it from the outside in a way. But on the other hand, I mean, Edwin will know these texts way better than most Indians will. So, you know, he's also justified to speak on them, you know. And again, like, it's not something I expect you to have an answer on, but it's an interesting thing to reflect upon, I suppose.
No, I don't think I have an answer. There's a book by Johannine Grinchpan about the Yoga Sutra called Silence Unheard. And one thing that he does at the beginning, which I think is really nice, is he's sort of doing a literature review, and he creates stereotypes to do the literature review with. So he's like, well, there's the, you know, disinterested outsider, there's the practitioner outsider. And I think he does some really helpful work there in analyzing the different relationships that people can have with the topics that they're studying. Because I don't think there is one answer. And I think that way of kind of seeing it in those different ways is quite helpful. But I do find his book really hard. And I have tried reading a few paragraphs at a time after drinking an espresso. And then you sort of have to stop reading and go and lie down in a dark room for a while. But I recommend it.
Maybe you need the techno going on in the background. Maybe the techno would help as well. Just put that on and the espresso. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's a cliche, isn't it? But, you know, the more this is, you know, talked about and you know, and people can hold, you know, and tolerate other people's opinions on these subjects as simply just reflections, then, you know, it's probably a positive thing, you know? because, you know, I mean, Edwin's done a huge amount of service to the yoga tradition, and, you know, and yet he's not necessarily claiming to be the last word on what yoga is. And also, you know, people growing up in India with, you know, with a cultural understanding of yoga will have that emotional resonance, you know, which goes super deep and is different to an understanding which is always going to be from the outside perspective, right? Like, you know, you'll never understand the Smiths in such a way, you know, even for me from London, for example, and it's a silly example, I know the music one, but in a way that someone who's grown up in that area of Manchester would understand, you know what I mean? Like, you know, it's going to be an emotional understanding. You can analyze that music all you like, but it's not going to be the same thing. And, yeah, it just...
Academia, like, especially when you're kind of thinking about doing your literature review, because as you start a project, you find the literature, read the literature, and it's so, and then the idea is it's like a conversation, you know, this conversation has been going on for decades, for centuries, and you're trying to kind of it's like walking into a room where everyone's been speaking and they all know what they're talking about and you don't know what's going on, and you're trying to kind of get up to speed with that conversation and to work out whether you have any sort of contribution, but it's not like any of those. So I'd see it as a kind of continuous flow of dialogue through time. I think that's what academia is, if you sort of take that metaphor of the conversation, and as a PhD student, you're sort of trying to jump into that conversation and sort of hoping that you're going to land in it. Okay. But I mean, who's got the last word, I guess is the point. Like, does anybody have the last word in this? It's going to continue, isn't it? Who is most entitled to speak, and should everyone else shut up? Well, the conversation is going to keep flowing.
Yeah. Is it the same as a German person being justified in having the last word on Nietzsche, for example, or, you know, whatever, you know? I mean, we've opened a discussion there, and I suppose, you know, this will continue, and you know, I think we can carry on and on with this, but I think I'll leave it there for now and just say, you know, thanks very much, Ruth, for your time. And look, let's just lighten the tone and just say, look, I always do this on the podcast. Give me a guilty pleasure and an inspiration, you know, just to finish it off and end on a slightly lighter note. Yeah, I do often do this. So I want an inspiration. Don't think too hard about it. Something inspires you, person, place, or thing, and a guilty pleasure. And as long as you don't say chocolate, I'm good with that.
Oh, right. Well, coffee. I don't know if that's a guilty pleasure, but I think
that's
it's,
right. Yeah, yeah, I'll go. I'll go with that. Well, yeah.
I can't function without it.
Yes,
but I suppose I feel guilty. Inspiration. I don't know if there's a. Yeah, I'm inspired by the people who have gone before, and I sort of say that in a really sort of personal way. You know, the people that are no longer with us.
Yeah. That's nice. That's a nice ending. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ruth, for joining me and giving me your time. So we've had a great conversation. And as always, please feel free to comment on this as long as it's nice. Thanks very much. And thanks, Ruth, again. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. Pleasure to join you today.